Sometimes in life, we're presented with opportunities sooner than expected, thus leaving us unprepared and needing to act fast. In the case of Kate Atwood, when a generous donation allowed for an opportunity to launch her foundation, she had to figure out how to fill in the pieces as she went.
And again, this was failure number one, but probably the biggest lesson and probably the most impactful lesson that still today I carry as a change agent in community. I'd gotten the suite for the circus donated to me. Boston Consulting Group, shout out to BCG because they believed in me when nobody else did. But they gave me their suite, Phillips Arena, for the circus. And I was so excited. I was like, my dream's coming true. It was little things. And I made these postcards. I still have these postcards too. I made these postcards and it was like open house at the suite. I had the time. And I was certain that if I built it, they would come. And this is a story that isn't told, and it's not really a part of the story of Kate's Club, but that February, a week before we were supposed to go into that suite, I had one problem. I didn't have any kids.
Also on this week's episode, we discuss overcoming adversity, leadership with love, and being the change. And now, episode 8 of Culturation.
Good evening, my fellow citizens.
Are you ready? The main event of the evening.
The ideas.
It's the word that you put in.
The ability.
Can you dig it?
The talent.
I'm going to show you how great I am.
All right, let's bring to the stage.
Those who influence. The entertainers. The business leaders. And the entrepreneurs. They're all right here on Culturation. And now, your host, Justin Epstein.
Welcome to Culturation. I'm your host, Justin Epstein. On this week's episode, we have the change agent, Kate Atwood. Kate was 12 years old when her mother passed away after a long and courageous battle with breast cancer. 12 years later, she founded Kate's Club, a nationally acclaimed not-for-profit organization that provides support to children and teens facing life after the death of a parent or sibling. Recognizing firsthand the importance of support after such a life-changing event, Kate's vision was to build a place for grieving children to have fun, develop friendships, and learn how to cope with their loss. What started in the summer of 2003 at a bowling alley with just 8 kids is today an organization that has served thousands of children and their families through year-round social and emotional support programs. Her first book, entitled A Healing Place, Help Your Child Find Hope and Happiness After the Loss of a Loved One, was released by Penguin Books. Following a successful founder transition in 2010, Kate went on to serve as the executive director of the Arby's Foundation. While at the helm of the Arby's Foundation, Kate refocused its efforts on a new strategic mission that more closely aligned with the Arby's brand and helped the organization contribute more than $18 million to ending childhood hunger in the United States. In September 2015, Kate joined the Metro Atlanta Chamber as Vice President of Marketing to lead the recently launched Choose ATL initiative. In this newly created role, Kate is responsible for focusing the region's narrative to showcase all that Metro Atlanta has to offer with the purpose to attract and retain top talent. Kate has participated in her fair share of media along the way. She has been featured in People Magazine, Real Simple Magazine, Marie Claire, Huffington Post, and has had appearances on The Today Show, The Meredith Vieira Show, CNN, and ABC TV's The View. She was recognized in the Atlanta Business Chronicle's feature Up and Comers, Top 40 Under 40, and was honored by Georgia Trend Magazine as one of Georgia's 40 Under 40. In 2013, she was named to Good Magazine's Global Good 100 list for her commitment to helping others. Kate has been featured in 6 books as a thought leader on personal giving and social entrepreneurship. With that being said, I'd like to welcome my good friend, founder, thought leader, overall amazing person, Kate Atwood, to the show. Kate, thanks for being here today.
Thank you for having me, Justin. I'm excited.
Definitely. So for those that may not be familiar with you and yourself, can you kind of give them a little bit of background on who you are, what you do, all that good stuff?
Sure. I kind of have worn several hats that people may be associated already with my work. The first one being the founder of Kate's Club. In Kate's Club, we're actually kind of heading into our 15th year as a nonprofit. We serve children and teens who've lost a parent or a sibling. And I started that really as a young creator here in Atlanta as a result of losing my mother when I was 12 years old. And as I got older and my world got bigger, I kind of went from thinking I was the only girl outside of Cinderella whose mom had died to understanding that a lot of kids actually lose their parent. In fact, 1 in 20 will lose their parent before they're 18.
Wow.
And we do nothing as a culture to support and empower these kids. So Kate's Club is that community. It's that world where it's okay to grieve. And in 15 years, we've just grown to reach remarkable levels of service and impact, mainly in Atlanta, but now we're kind of expanding into other parts of the state and even across some other states that we're doing work with. So founder of Kate's Club, I am currently the executive director of Choose ATL, which is really a fun project that I've been on that carries the charge of attracting, you know, young emerging talent to Atlanta. So in a way, it's kind of marketing Atlanta to the next generation, which is a fascinating job in itself, but also has implications around economic development, how we will intentionally grow the Atlanta metro region to kind of reach the vibrancy and the potential that I think we know it can with that work. So I guess those are my two main things.
Those are two pretty big things, by the way.
Yeah.
So, all right. We got a lot to talk about then.
Okay.
So I just want to kind of, you know, take it back. Where did you grow up?
Because
I definitely want to expand upon these two things a bit more as we get further into the interview. So.
Sure. So I actually grew up in Charlottesville, Virginia, which I realized, you know, a couple months ago, people would always get that confused with Charleston or Charlotte. But now we all really have, I think, kind of a unfortunately, we have an association with Charlottesville, Virginia.
Yeah.
But I grew up there and had a wonderful, wonderful childhood. It was my dad was an architect. My mom was a teacher. And it was just straight up like middle class, you know, just awesome, comfortable, exciting childhood up until, I guess, that fateful day when I was 12 years old in April and my mom passed away. And that obviously was the biggest kind of first turning point for my life.
And I think, you know, from what I read and what we talked about, I think your mother, you first found out about, though, years before that, correct? It was at, was it the age of six?
Six. So, yeah, I mean, my mom, and this is, I mean, what's so fascinating. Sometimes we think time can have been so long, but it actually, you know, my mom was diagnosed in the late 80s with breast cancer. And I was 6 years old. And at that time, believe it or not, there was still like a stigma around that word cancer. There wasn't the resources, certainly not the research or even kind of the medical facility that we now have today. But I kind of first experienced, you know, what that word was, you know, when I was just learning my, you know, my ABCs,
yeah,
super young. And she would go on to, you know, to fight cancer for the next 6 years. I didn't really ever, I think, understand the weight of it, certainly not on her life. And I give my parents a lot of credit for that. They didn't want it to take away from my brother and I's childhood. But then that also made that day, you know, that she was, that she did die, it just made it like, what? It felt as if it was just a shock in the moment of time, even though we had kind of been dealing with it for several years.
Yeah, I mean, you know, a lot of kids, we deal with stuff when we're young,
yeah,
but never to really the magnitude of what you're saying. So, you know, seeing this kind of growing up and kind of what your mother went through, but also being a fighter, an inspiration, an advocate for it, does that also kind of contest to what you have now done with your life? Is that a big part of kind of mentally what you saw and kind of gave you the drive to want to help so many people?
Yeah, you know, I, here's the thing is, you know, we, and I speak from this obviously now with many more years behind it, but, you know, for me, that moment was the puncture of my innocence. But every person has that moment in which their, you know, their innocence is punctured as a child. Some, it even happens way before that, certainly in different, you know, different ways and different capacities. But what I found was when I was 12 years old and lost my mom, you know, I spent an adolescence like walking around just being like, why me? You know, not having any visible example or any model of this happening to anybody. I mean, I just was like, whose mom dies? Nobody's moms don't die. And ironically, I was associating it with, you know, every fairy tale princess whose mom dies, you know, but that we seem to skip over that scene in the movie.
Exactly, yeah.
we enter in the scene where it's like, oh, she doesn't have a mom, you know.
Yeah. And then she grows. Yeah. And they never touch on that.
Yeah, they don't, you know. And so I was kind of I became fascinated by that. But I think what was interesting, I was big into sports and certainly basketball, and that became my vehicle for like expressing emotion, which I too found quite ironic. Like I remember, you know, being in the locker room after a game and just like totally crying because we lost the game, and that being more socially acceptable than me crying because my mom had died, you know. So all of these moments, these little moments and trying to walk this walk through my adolescence, meanwhile just already dealing with being a teenager, I just started to realize like we do this all wrong, all wrong. And when I got older and I went on to school, actually went to the University of Virginia and started to work with kids, you know, who had lost a parent, because when I found out there was, you know, some sort of service around this, I was fascinated by it. It really opened my world to, wow, this happens a lot more than our culture and our society acknowledges. And that is a real, real shame.
You know, it's a great point. You never think about it. I mean,
yeah.
We all have friends whose, you know, our friends have passed away. Our parents
yep.
have friends that have passed away. And you don't ever really talk about it. It happens. You grieve and whatever your grieving process is. But we don't openly address it and have a support system.
Yeah.
So, you know, I feel like, do you feel like that's kind of where sports was so important? Because that's the best support system in a lot of ways for a kid.
Yeah.
In that situation.
It is a less, and we can talk about this because, you know, this is obviously my kind of the bigger thesis around Kate's Club. But things like sports, things like music, even just outdoor activity, I mean, is way, it's the vocabulary of a kid, you know, and often what I talk about is like, if we have a person who's young and doesn't have the sophisticated, you know, dictionary of words to talk about anxiety or, you know,
yeah.
or depression, you know, these heavy, intimidating words, get them on a field, you know, get them in front of a canvas, get them in a way that it meets them where they're at. It's all about expression, right? And so fast forward, I mean, that's a big part of what we do at Kate's Club. But I have one real big story that happened when I was, you know, 18. And that was the moment that my whole outlook on this life event changed. And I think it's an important one because, you know, I talked about walking my adolescence and, you know, just feeling super alone and odd, you know, it made for, you know, hard, even though I was like social and I was class president, you know, I was checking all the boxes on the exterior.
But interior wise.
I was like totally a shell of a human. And I went to volunteer at this camp, it was a camp for kids who had lost a parent. I was like, well, I got to check this out. Like,
yeah. This
is like the weirdest.
You're like, this
and
exists.
Most, yeah, this exists. But I was just fascinated. Like, what did this look like? So I show up at the camp and the camp director comes up to me and she's like, you know, you're the youngest volunteer who has a loss. Do you mind opening camp with your story? And I was like, well, I haven't talked about my mom in 7 years. I mean, not even to my best friend.
Wow.
I had not talked about my mom or shared a story about her. That just wasn't invited in my home. It wasn't invited in my school or community. And that was just the stigma around grief that existed. So I got up on stage and like for the first time, I mean, I just like, whew, talk about like just freeloading. I'm just like, I don't know if I was up there for like 5 minutes or 50.
Just blacked out.
Yeah. I just went with it. I just ran with it. And there was such a freeing experience for me. But, you know, it was up until that point that it was still kind of all about me.
Yeah.
And I came off stage, you know, 18, like I've got my shit together, like, you know, thinking I was like kind of on top of the world in this experience. But it was still kind of all about me. And that night I was, you know, in the cabin and I was brushing my teeth and a young girl came up and like tapped me on the shoulder and I turned around and she said, "You're Kate, right?" And I said, "Yes." And she said, just so familiar. She said, well, I lost my mom and my dad. And she just went on to tell me her story. It was in that moment that I was like, wow, this is what this is about. Like, this isn't about me. This is about her. And the fact that years before I had the chance to tell my story, she just felt comfortable telling hers.
So that was kind of like your aha moment.
Yeah.
You know, I always talk about, you know, life. We go through a million things.
Yeah.
And I can't even remember what I ate yesterday.
Yeah.
But there's certain moments in my life that I can see as clear today that I know shifted my life and was like a game changer.
Yeah.
So this definitely sounds like this was the first one for you that really kind of put that clarity in.
Yeah.
So let me ask you a question. I'm curious on this. When I kind of want to know what your mind state was, and the fact that a lot of people go through certain things, in your case, your mother's passing, and it almost, their life takes a different direction. They can't get through it, or they turn to things, whether it be drugs or other stuff like that. However, in your case, you're a school president, you're popular, you're social, you're functioning, like you said, well on the outside, not inside. What was giving you kind of that drive, or how were you managing to stay on the up and up versus going the other way?
Yeah, I think there's kind of this, I love that question, and I'll answer it in two parts. The first is, I do think there are some of us that just are wired to be more driven to move forward, to be more external in kind of how we interact with the world, right? But at some point, all of us have a path that requires us to either, you know, kind of fold within or go without. And that is the difference between somebody, you know, isolating themselves and becoming a victim of their adversity and somebody who opens themselves up to ask for help and to express themselves and, you know, be a survivor. And I like those two words. They're completely two ends of the spectrum for me. I don't know if I would have had that moment with that young girl if I wouldn't have started to slide to be more introverted. I was gifted that moment to realize that this is all about asking for help. This is all about understanding that you heal from any wound by healing together. I have yet to see an outcome of somebody who has healed all alone.
Yeah.
It just doesn't happen. Like, we live in a relational world. So I think when you start to see victims, I think we're starting to see it a lot. If I can get a little bit on that soapbox, you know, when you start to have people who are, for no explanation, doing mass shootings, doing, you know, wrecking havoc on society, they are doing it by themselves, and they are doing it in a most catastrophic way, detrimental to many beyond them, right? Total lack of empathy, total lack of any kind of societal connection. Those are people who have had adversity and who have not dealt with anything on the exterior.
Yeah.
And I would like, I'll go on the record and blanket that across all of these cases.
Yeah.
They're all different in themselves. They are all over the world, but that to me is that pivotal fork in the road of when we have somebody who can be healthy in their interaction in society and somebody who can't.
So you noticed that moment, like you said, you were aware of it when it happened for you. How many times do you think people are presented with that moment or that game-changing situation, and they either elect to go against their gut, not address it, or just based on comfort, it's easier to kind of turn away and say, not really trying to really deep dive into this?
You know, what makes me so passionate about this work is that I think, unfortunately, right now, in the current time, we have more people that miss that moment. And the reason I say that is because, again, yes, there are these extreme cases of, you know, detrimental outcomes that we see in the headline of the news. But there are also little smaller cases that I see in different environments, whether it's our work environment, whether it's, you know, even just kind of walking around the neighborhood in some of our communities, where if you're in an environment where the norm is for people to like project, you know, toxicity or ill emotions, and they're and it's coming out in an environment that it has nothing to do with. So we'll use the office, for example. Then that's when, to me, it's like we as a society are allowing that to be the norm rather than working on being healthy people ourselves, asking for help, and then being able to come back around, you know, with things like more grace, you know, with understanding intention, and getting away from this ill projection of just hatred and, you know, words that are detrimental, you know, to any human being, let alone a society of human beings. So I know that sounds like really kind of philosophical, but I do think right now we are living in a state where it is more normal to not deal with your shit than where we need to go, which is dealing with your shit. And hopefully with this generation, I mean, I know Kate's Club, when I talk about a world where it's okay to grieve, I know Kate's Club is a small contingency of that. But if we can change how we approach loss and grief and adversity, and we do so in a community-based environment, I really do think the outcome of everything from our, you know, on the ground community to our leaders at the top level, I just feel like that whole energy and environment would be different.
No, I completely agree. And I think you used a key word, which is community.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of times the community, if they step up and come together and can be that support system, it could be a game changer. A game changer. So now you go through high school, you have this experience at this camp that kind of changes your life. You're 18 years old. Now the next step is obviously college.
So I was just starting college. And I was just so fed by this moment that I was like going back and forth to this camp in the summer. But like sports was still my thing at this point.
So basketball still.
Yeah.
Okay.
I wasn't playing.
Okay. Are you a fan of which team at this point? I'm curious, just in professional sports.
True to Atlanta for sure.
Okay.
Got to be the Hawks. I mean, I'd love what that team does for the sport in terms of entertainment. Virginia basketball all the way.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, Tony Bennett, like our team, we have a team. We struggle on the football field, but like we have a basketball team. I grew up with like Ralph Sampson. I mean, remember, I grew up in Charlottesville, so I had like Virginia basketball kind of to
everywhere.
But then, I mean, ACC basketball, obviously. I mean, that is,
I'm a Duke fan.
And I the reason I value that is I just think ACC basketball season is like the best. So I didn't make it, you know, to play here. This is kind of fun. I don't, you know, this is like a total tangent, but so I was like a shooting guard, like 5'6" in my sophomore year and was like starting to get looked at and like thought I was gonna be able to play in college.
Okay.
And then in one summer I grew 4 inches.
4 inches in one summer.
Yeah. And I came back like super awkward, super slow. So for people that can't see but are listening to this, so like I'm now, you know, 5'12", I say 5'12", you know, I'm 6 feet tall, like, and I went from being average height, quick shooting guard, like I was good, to just slow and awkward, and like my game went out the window.
See, I had the opposite problem. I never really made a height spurt. You know, I stopped at the 5'7", and I was hoping I was going to keep going. It just never happened. So my basketball dreams, well, I did play ball, and I played in club and high school and all that. You know, my dreams of playing at Duke, I had to go to soccer because soccer was just more reliable at that point for a 5'7" guy. I wasn't really dunking on anybody at 5'7".
Yeah. Well, so soccer, the coach, when I tried out for soccer when I was
young.
Team.
UVA, really good team.
Yeah. When I was younger, and I was, because I was just doing everything, the coach pulled my parents aside and said, you know, we feel like this is an early enough time in her soccer experience to kind of guide you guys to have her stick with sports that use her hands, because her like I was like 10 and they're sitting there telling my parents this. So they had to break the news that, yeah, like, unless I wanted to be goalie, I probably wasn't going to make the soccer team. I was like, I don't want to be goalie. So I gave up on soccer. So I was in college, and I do think that what I was gravitating towards, now that I can kind of look back, was just this idea of community. I loved sport. Like, I love live sporting events. I loved So I entered in the marketing and promotions department through college because there's just not a better feeling of walking into a stadium or arena and just witnessing the people that are there to experience it. You know, I kind of joke, it's like of all the convenings in our world and in our society, a sporting event, like 96% of the people want to be there.
Yeah.
You know, there are some I'm sure that are
that just get dragged there with their friends.
But yeah, there's no other setting where the majority of people want to be there. And so much spectrum of emotion comes out too. Yeah. You know, the competitiveness, the anger, the, you know, the excitement. Like, so I'm fascinated by the study of that community. So I got into sports, and that's what actually brought me to Atlanta.
Got it.
So graduated from college and got a job with the Peach Bowl, now the Chick-fil-A Bowl, which was the football game. And I mean, just a dream of a job for like freshly out of college, you know, let's go build a week of parties in you know, a football game.
Yeah.
So, and I loved sports, and I worked, got my first job after the internship, got my first job in NASCAR. And again, which at the time, you know, early 2000s, NASCAR was just kind of coming on the map as like a major player for brands and, you know, for kind of the NASCAR property. So I just learned a ton, was having so much fun. And I was at dinner. This is another big memory that I have. I was at dinner that Anis, that French bistro, with my dad. And, you know, my dad and my brother and I, so there were like three of us. And what happens a lot with families, especially with families where the mother, you know, the caregiver, the kind of the emotional glue, the emotional caregiver dies, is you just start to kind of find your own way. You know, there's nothing really holding you guys together as a unit. And I always say it's not out of the lack of love. We always loved each other, but it was out of the presence of grief. We did not know how to navigate around each other with grief. And that's an important thing to remember, because I think a lot of families, especially as adults, think that they should kind of go into it all together, counseling, whatever that, you know, may be. But we have to remember in grief, it is not about the same human dying. It's about the different relationship
that
is gone. So for each person to be able to deal with their grief separately and then to come back to a unit, that's a big thing that we've now applied at Kate's Club, because it was something that I saw happen with my family. But my dad and I were starting to come back together. We had really started to come back together around this kind of me volunteering in this camp. My dad was an architect, entrepreneur. He was always like, and this is what I always kind of joke with my girlfriends, like, I didn't have the mom that was in my ear, like, get married, you know, do this so you look cute for boys and all that stuff. But I did have the dad that was like, you can do anything you want. You better go for it. You know, you're like, just be bold, big, dream big. If anybody can do it, you know, so I had that tape in my ear. So, you know, at 22 years old, sitting at dinner with my dad, and I was just like, I need these kids in my life more. I mean, it was almost those simple words that came out of my mouth, that then he was like, well, why don't you start something? And I was like, well,
he's like, all right,
how do
let's
I
go.
Do that? Yeah. You know,
where do I start?
And he's like, well, you should just, you know, start. And at this point, I also like to kind of frame the time of, This was before starting a nonprofit.
Yeah, it wasn't as common.
No, it was not the cool thing. In fact, I remember being like, well, how do you make money? You know?
Yeah.
We associated it more with the word charity than we did with kind of not-for-profit business, right? So I had a lot of learning to do, but my dad and I just, you know, sketched out kind of on a napkin that night how, you know, what Kate's Club would be.
Very, very cool.
Yeah.
All right. So now you write it on a napkin. You have an idea for, you know, this foundation, this cause. Where do you kind of go from here? Yeah. What's the next step?
You know, it's funny because most people, I think, look at their bank account or make some reasonable decision based on, you know, the finances that they have afforded to them at that moment before they go do something big.
Understandable.
I, you know, for some reason, all I needed was my dad to say, go do it. And I was like, okay, I'll find that way. And so, you know, like any, I think, kind of marketer, I went to PowerPoint. I just started.
Strong. Do you still use PowerPoints? Do you still use them?
Or Keynote. I mean, I think
okay,
we've
okay, no, that makes me better. Keynote. Yeah, yeah. I just want to put out a public service announcement to everybody out there. Keynote is way better than PowerPoint at this point in the game. You can do more with it. You can make it prettier, yeah, aesthetically, creatively.
But I still, you know, it's funny. I went and I didn't even write a business plan. I just made a PowerPoint presentation.
It's all text.
And I actually recently found it.
Okay.
So this is a funny story because, again, this is before Facebook. This is like, I'll put you in 2002. You know, there weren't crowdfunding platforms. There were not resources to help people start nonprofit organizations.
Yeah.
The only one that I had heard of that had started in the past, you know, 20, 30 years was Dress for Success. And, you know, that was another young person who had started with $5,000. I didn't even have $5,000. So I did what anybody who knew where money was coming from a gift and charity standpoint did, and that was I wrote to Oprah Winfrey.
Oprah knows all.
She was accessible, right? So I am not kidding you. Before I asked for a dollar from anybody else, I was like, let me just hit it out of the park from, you know,
just hit my girl O.
Yeah, yeah. I've always felt connected to Oprah. And so I made this PowerPoint presentation. I was so naive. I had no idea what I was doing. But man, I had a vision. And I had my dad, remember, he's an architect, so he did the renderings of the clubhouse. I mean, we were like there before we were.
Love it.
Yeah. And sent that off and then, you know, kind of realized that I had to get something going. I'll tell you, early stage, it was a big vision, but the recipe was actually very simple. And it wasn't some mad scientist, you know, idea. All I wanted to do was get a group of kids together. And while I didn't have money, I had been in sports. So I knew how to get access to museums and tickets to games and, you know, low cost activities that could begin to introduce this new approach to grief that was about friendship, that was about fun, you know, having a child have a visceral moment where they can say, it's okay to cry, but it's also okay to laugh. It's okay to live again. It would have totally changed those adolescent years for me, without a doubt, if I just would have had that, seen that and been a part of that. So I didn't want to do, I wasn't trying to be the counseling. I wasn't trying to be the licensed therapist. I didn't have any of those credentials. But I knew the power of just getting these kids together and going out and doing something fun together where they could start to get to know each other.
But the most important thing is you had real life experience in this area.
Exactly. So I would show up with like a resume. Because that was one of my big challenges. It's like, how am I going to get these parents to give me their kids, you know? And I was super intentional. And this is an important part. I was super intentional about the first group of kids. Because I wanted to prove that not only was this about, you know, building community, but that the premature loss of a parent was one of the very unique things in our society that knew no socio boundaries. So it didn't know socioeconomics, it didn't know race, it didn't know ethnicity, it didn't even know faith. It totally equalized the human on a level that could be so empowering that I don't think our world had ever thought about that, you know? So I was like, okay, I'm going to go out and I'm going to do something fun and I'm going to get these kids around the table. And again, this was failure number one, but probably the biggest lesson and probably the most impactful lesson that still today I carry as a change agent in community. I'd gotten the suite for the circus donated to me. Boston Consulting Group. Shout out to BCG because they believed in me when nobody else did. But they gave me their suite, Phillips Arena, for the circus. And I was so excited. I was like, my dream's coming true. It was little things. And I made these postcards. I still have these postcards too. I made these postcards and it was like open house at the suite, had the time. And I was certain that if I built it, they would come. And this is a story that isn't told. It's not really a part of the story of Kate's Club. But that February, a week before we were supposed to go into that suite, I had one problem. I didn't have any kids.
Just a little problem.
Just a little problem.
Yeah.
So I had to give this, I had this humble moment where I had to go back to, you know, this wonderful company that was giving me their suite and saying, I don't have any kids, I can't use this suite. And it was a big pivot moment for me because I realized, like, it's not about if I build it, they will come. It's about meeting them where they're at, giving them the vision and the, you know, guidance to of what I'm trying to create, and then bringing them along with me. So that was big.
Yeah.
And I do think that is how, if you ever want to create social change, you have to meet people where they're at. You can't start way over here in left field and expect that people will come over there, even if your idea is going to solve for every human dilemma.
Yeah. Well, there's too much outside clutter in this world. There's too much noise.
Yeah.
So you got to go out and get it. You know, but what I love, and I feel like this was a big deal of what you did, and I feel like more people would be successful, and I'm curious your outlook on this, if they did this, is you weren't waiting for everything to be perfectly aligned and done and ready. You closed the deal on something and then said, I'm going to figure it out how to get the kids.
Yeah.
You know, and I feel like a lot of people are waiting, like you're saying, the same way you're saying you need to go to them and get people and get what you need.
Yeah.
A lot of people also are waiting on their dreams, waiting on the perfect moment. There is no perfect moment. If you want to get shit done, just go get it done.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think from that, I always just say, one, you know, you're totally going to make missteps. You know, if you have a vision, like, honor that vision, but give, like, grace and freedom that how you get there is still totally up for grabs. You know, I mean, there's so much that in 15 years that is manifested from this original vision. And I had the first PowerPoint, and it's crazy how much of it aligns.
Is it a lot of it still accurate?
A lot of it aligns. And some things are bigger than I could have imagined. Some things never happened, but it's amazing how much it aligned. But the course of what got me there, first of all, was not Oprah sending me a big check.
Oprah, you still have a chance to get in. Like,
that didn't happen. But it was, again, just the playing field to allow it to manifest.
You know, you talk about writing it down and how it's manifested.
Mm-hmm.
The more people I speak to that are extremely successful, like yourself, in different areas of life and business, they all swear by writing things down. They all swear that you've got to put it down. You got to envision it. I'm a big believer putting things in the universe.
Yep.
But do you feel like writing it down, thinking it, believing it, seeing it was instrumental for you?
Absolutely. But I'm also like, I know enough about me that it wasn't enough for me to just write it down in like a journal somewhere.
So you had to get real with yourself.
I think to take it to the next level of accountability, I had to put it out. Like, I had to show it to people. I had to, like, and I'm not, I know that's not for everybody, but like, sometimes I struggle with, like, I do vision boards, but then sometimes I struggle because I'm like, this isn't happening, you know. Like, I don't, there's something there. But for me, you just, when you start to take that first step, I think it's beautiful to write it down and have a vision, but that cannot underscore also the fact that you've got to start taking steps towards it. Because nothing, to your point, nothing will happen. Nothing will kind of arrive at your doorstep. And I was learning so much of that, in these early days.
I think you make a really valid point, though, which I never really thought about it, is you have to understand yourself first and do what you know is going to work for you. Because a lot of people, you read these books or you listen to these podcasts, and people say, this is how I did it, right? And then we want to kind of implement and look at that as kind of our blueprint.
Yep.
But if I'm a person, like, I know myself, I don't write things down.
Yeah.
I have to put them in calendars. I have my system that works for me. It looks like unorganized beauty, but for me, it's perfect.
Right.
So I feel like you do. That's kind of probably the first step in all of it, is knowing how you operate to then succeed accordingly.
But I think, like, the whole reason you choose to be an entrepreneur is because it's the journey of your life self, of your work and who you are and what your makeup is. I think anybody can be an entrepreneur. I totally think anybody can, but you have to be willing, first and foremost, to reflect and become, you know, do the self-awareness work with yourself. Every point at which I look at a shift or a growth or a setback or anything as an entrepreneur, it very much had to do with me not knowing myself well enough. So I'm still learning about myself. You know, I'm still learning. I'm still, you know, on that journey and navigating accordingly. But that is, I think being an entrepreneur brings it out and, you know, kind of extracts it in a bit more of a dynamic way, which is kind of the fun part.
Yeah,
I find it.
Well, so, for you and I, we find it fun. For others, it may be
a little
crazy.
Yeah.
So back to kind of your journey here. So now you get this suite. You're missing everything from a children's standpoint, which you need to put in this suite. So kind of where do you go from there?
So I did. I remember being very like, okay, this is a humbling moment. So I got to rethink how I approach this. And I've got to just be very intentional about getting these kids and not try to do some big fanfare of a circus, but like, let's just bring it down a notch. Let's go bowling. Bowling's really fun. It's a kind of an open environment. So the parents can come there if they feel like they need to like be comfortable with it, whatever. And then I just went out and started meeting families. So I worked with children's healthcare and hospice and some, you know, boys and girls clubs to just allow them to, if they knew somebody, to kind of meet. And I would go to coffee shops and I would meet these families, and I would bring my resume, you know, references. You know, I knew that one, I was there to make the parent feel comfortable with me, and then the kids to feel comfortable with me. And there is two funny things that happened. Like, I remember one of the first families I met, three little girls, they had lost their dad. And I walk in, and remember, I mean, I'm like 22. I look like I'm, you know, like their age. Yeah. Like, I look like a kid, you know? But I think that was kind of part of what worked.
Yeah, probably more comfortable with that.
Yeah. So this little girl looked at her older sister and she goes, she didn't look like what I thought she looked like. And so I was just like, well, what did you think I was going to look like? And she said, I thought you'd be old and wearing black. And at that moment, I knew what I was doing was counterculture, because here was a young person who was very simply stating what her perception of grief was. And it was the exact perception that we had as a culture. You know, grief is sad. Grief is not something that young people should deal with, you know. It's, you know, scary and solemn and lonely. And at that point, I think what naturally came out of my mouth was like, well, I'm young and, you know, I am all about having fun. And that's what this is going to be about. And I think to this day, if you were to walk into the Kate's Club clubhouse, everything that we touch, everything that we do has a sense of vibrancy and a sense of life about it. And, you know, and the parents were just like, I just wanted my kids to hear your story. And it was at that point that I realized how my most valuable currency was my story, and how I was going to really have to lean into my story to build this brand. And one of the, just a little side note, one of the things about Kate's Club that is really cool is that, you know, especially from a culture standpoint, is that when I started Kate's Club, you know, the oldest nonprofit around helping kids through loss, you know, is only like 30 years old now. So 15 years ago, it still was a pretty new thing. There are about 200 organizations around the United States that were doing similar work, either out of hospice or kind of a support group. There were camps like that I'd been a part of. But every single one of them were named after the person who had died.
Wow.
So Kate's Club is the only brand in childhood bereavement that is a living brand. And that may seem like not a big deal, but it's a huge deal, because Kate's Club isn't about the person who died.
Yeah.
It is about the survivor. It is about the kid who still has a full life to live.
You're injecting the fun and the happiness into these kids versus reflecting on a death.
And the movement forward, yeah. And the reflection of the death is important. That is a big piece of what we do. But the mission is around the kid who is surviving. The mission is around that kid being on a new track, but how we keep that track moving forward.
So how many kids did you end up securing for your first big
six.
Event? Six. All right. That's strong.
We had six kids and we went bowling. And from there, we just started adding, I mean, literally just little by little. And I would rent a van and I would drive very intentionally from Bankhead to Buckhead, from Douglasville to Decatur, making sure I captured the unique makeup of who this community of kids could be. And it's one of the things I'm most proud of is these kids, you know, I dare to say there's another community of kids in Atlanta that is this diverse in its makeup for all the reasons that, you know, I just explained, all the reasons that separate us in our community and society. And they are the most empathetic, the most tolerant, the most compassionate kids I've ever bared witness to. And that's something that I think could inspire a lot of us adults, because they learn from their grief and from their grievances that there are great gifts that can, you know, they can take out to the world.
So you've had now 15 years, it's going on 15 years of this club. How many kids have come through over the 15 years, would you say?
Yeah, you know, I don't know the total number, honestly. It's probably something that we should figure out as we start.
I know there's a lot.
Yeah, there's a lot. I will say that annually we serve, on average annually we serve, I think it's about 1,000 kids come through our clubhouse. Wow. And now, like I mentioned, we're doing support groups kind of all over the state. We only have one, like kind of clubhouse kind of, you know, main central headquarters. I wish we had the capital to do more. It comes down to money.
Yeah.
But we've also, I really honor the fact that we have not tried to jump on some, you know, the American way is like franchise as fast as you can. And I've always hated that for nonprofits, because I think you lose so much intimacy and so much quality of service when you start to get bureaucratic.
Yeah.
With these types of organizations. So I'm super proud of how far we've come. You know, we're doing support groups and we have relationships with every school system. So we're in the schools. We're starting to do Boys and Girls Club programming kind of in other states around the country. So the cadence of it has been beautiful, you know, and it's been tough. I mean, it's been tough, but it's, you know, it's been, I feel so lucky that I get to like just watch this legacy grow, you know.
When you look back at the napkin writing,
yeah,
from that first day to where you are now, is it just mind-blowing?
It is mind-blowing. It's mind-blowing because it's allowed me, one, to see just the best of humanity coming from a place where I just thought that whose mom dies, you know?
Yeah.
That I think that's been just amazing to witness. And then, again, I've kind of done my career backwards, in that I'm still trying to, you know, figure out like what that thread is. Like, I don't really know what I'm really good at, but I got to do my legacy piece first. So it's a beautiful thing, to be able to live that out.
Yeah.
You know, I ran Kate's Club for 7 years. I didn't want my career to be in childhood bereavement, but I wanted, and honestly, too, I'll share, like, every single one of those days for 7 years, I was in over my head. You got to be really careful with that when you're young and inexperienced, because you'll burn out. And I burn out. I mean, you know, people, you know, I can kind of publicly say easily that, like, yeah, you know, I came to the board and I just said kind of I was done. And we had the, you know, the turnover. It was way more complicated than that. It was way harder than that. And I feel like that will be kind of my next book, is I'll get real raw around the founder syndrome, because I think it's a real, real deal thing. And I think it's one of those things that the stigma of it doesn't allow us to really talk about it. So there are a lot of founders that try to go through the process without being really given the tools or the roadmap and how to deal with that.
It's a great idea. I mean, yeah, you know, you always think about it. Everybody, if you're a founder, everybody that works with you or below you or different levels, and I say below, not in the sense that you're any better, but in the sense that just roles within the company and responsibilities, yeah, you don't really have that support.
Mm-mm.
Unless you speak to other founders or other people going through it. So a lot of times you're up at night dealing with it by yourself, running through it with yourself. So it's almost like you're kind of going through what you went with in an early age with the passing. Now in an older age, dealing with the business emotional side of it.
Yeah, and I think for me, again, I was so young.
It's a lot to go through at 22, 23, 24.
I was dealing with something I hadn't dealt with. So I was dealing with my, you know, I was going through my own kind of grief journey while I was launching a company. And then on top of that, the public started paying attention. So then I started to become a bit of a media darling, CNN, The View, People Magazine, all these things that when you're young, you're like, oh my God, like, who's Britney Spears? I'm Kate Atwood, you know? but when you're not equipped to deal with that,
it's a lot of pressure.
And you, your first run out of the gate, you start to, you go down the path of all your validity being from the outside world. It's a very dangerous place to be. So it was almost like this just perfect storm for me to just...
It was the right time just like, to kind of step back.
Yeah, but it was the perfect storm for me to like totally just burn out and break down. And that's really what happened.
And during that time, though, you also... Now, when you wrote a book.
Yeah.
Was that...
Yeah, so, and then I got a book deal. Like, so I'm sitting here like having this breakdown, like totally like losing my shit over, you know... Kate's Club, and can I take it to the next level, and am I the right person, and by the way you have this like bug, you know, buzzing in your ear that is like founder syndrome, you know, don't stay too long, don't leave too early, like all of these voices in your head, but this is what the world expects now, you know, you've got a book to, like, you know, shit that it mounted up, and I really I didn't have the public Britney Spears breakdown, but that was the hardest year of my life.
I'll tell you, though, what's fascinating, though, about it is you're always, it seems like whatever you've gone through in life, though, you're super aware of what you're going through, which I think a lot of people, especially at a young age, ego-wise, you don't think, I'm going to step away from what I built, it's mine. You kind of have that sense of, you know, I'm not going to let somebody else run my business. And a lot of people end up running their companies into the ground for that reason.
Yeah. And I'll just point out, because you bring up a good point, and this is, I think, the thing that was kind of the frying pan that didn't allow me to go there, was that for good about, and again, like I would have done things differently knowing this now, but I didn't know it because we didn't know a lot about the nonprofit world. But when you start a nonprofit, you know, it's like starting a public company on day one. That is the hardest environment to build a vision around, because you have public stakeholders on day one. You legally don't own anything, including your name or your story in the nonprofit world, you know? I mean, yeah, you can now kind of, you know, get, you know, I think now people get attorneys and they, you know, IP and all that stuff. But back then, like, nobody was thinking about that. So I didn't have any legal authority to be like, this is mine, this is how we'll do it, like da 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 da. You know, I truly was forced to give it up to the bigger, and I don't mean forced in like a threatening way. I just mean
that was your only option.
I had to let it go because I didn't have the capability, like I didn't have the capacity to go any further with it. And it wasn't about me. It was about these kids. You know, we had to have that succession happen without any of the service that we were providing or, you know, the kids that we were serving feel any of it.
Yeah.
And that was freaking hard to navigate.
Yeah.
We did our best. You know, we did our best, but it was a long year and it was hard, and I was trying to write a book.
Just little stuff here. Way to not put a lot on your plate.
Yeah.
So now you eventually step out of the club, mm-hmm. and now you got to go, okay, what next am I going to do with my life? You know, am I going to go work in a completely different arena? Am I going to do this? But yet somehow you end up back into foundations and that world. So,
well, here's the thing, Justin, is that unlike when you sell a for-profit company, there is no cash transaction when you hand over a nonprofit.
Yeah.
So I was broke when I started it. I was broke while I ran it, and I was broke when I handed it over. So I couldn't afford this like Tahiti like 3-month getaway where I could find myself and get clear on what I want to go do.
You weren't IPOing for like $1 billion after a week. Yeah.
No, I had to freaking make money. As I kind of said, I was like, you know, my Karma bank account was full at capacity. My real bank account was completely at zero. I had to quickly move into a job to make money. You know, I had to almost kind of, I call it now my gas mask, like kind of my gas mask moment, where I just had to kind of slow down, do something that would still, you know, allow me to learn, to have purpose and add value, which are kind of my three things about career. But I knew it probably wasn't going to be the most like this big wild startup thing again, because I just needed to.
You needed a break.
Yeah. I needed a break. And I got so lucky, really, really lucky. I do remember lying in bed one night and I was just like, God, I just started praying. I was like, you either need to show me the man or show me the money, because I need help right now. And I got a job offer the next day. So the man didn't show up. But so I got this amazing opportunity to go and join the Arby's family at a critical point for that brand. You know, the Arby's brand was going through a turnaround, and the CEO at the time saw the foundation as an opportunity, kind of as an asset that wasn't being used to really help the brand. It's when corporations were just starting to get smart about how what they did out in the community should align with their work, not just be kind of a handout. So I went to Arby's and I relaunched the Arby's Foundation and did again a very counterculture move. So I'll talk a little bit about that, because you know, I walked into Arby's and they were big with youth mentoring, and that was great. They were doing great work, and you know, they were really making an impact. But from a brand standpoint, they weren't getting any lift from it. And it, you know, Arby's is, you know, largest, you know, fast food restaurant chains in the U.S. And so we kind of, you know, there was, you know, it's actually part of a consultancy that I was and ahead of, like, joining Arby's, that had recommended, so this group, Because Marketing, which I was a part of, and, you know, in that window, and kind of the brilliant partner of Because Marketing had recommended that we go after childhood hunger. And I thought that was brilliant, because at the time, the only thing people were talking about was childhood obesity. Yet when you started to look kind of further, you know, even at the causes of childhood obesity, they were intrinsically linked, and we had a huge food insecurity problem. Now, what was brave for Arby's was that people were not talking about food insecurity, and they certainly weren't talking about fast food as helping anything having to do with kids and nutrition. So, but the reality is that fast food was an access point for low socioeconomic families. It is where they were going to get their meals. So, duh, if you really want to be a company that's having an impact, why don't you make that access point a better choice for them, you know, and then you can start to do the work on food insecurity. So we revamped the kids menu, you know, had kind of a kids meal that followed the national regulations for the free lunch. So we could serve a free meal out of the Arby's restaurants, or we could, you know, provide access to wholesome meal out of the Arby's restaurants, and then go out in the community and work with our franchisees to help in childhood hunger. And I do think that us jumping in the game as a consumer-facing brand in that kind of counterculture light helped really evolve the understanding from just being childhood obesity to really people seeing that we have a food insecurity problem.
Yeah. And I think, what is it? I think in the state of Georgia, it was 1 in 5 kids, and now it's 1 in 4. Yeah. So, I mean, it's pretty unbelievable. Yeah.
And I'll tell one quick story about that, because I think when I took this role, kind of like with my learning from Kate's Club, I was like, if I'm going to be a mouthpiece, and if Arby's is going to be a mouthpiece, then we have to be able to communicate to the world what exactly it looks like and feels like. Because I think what people wanted to see was, they wanted to see starvation. They wanted to see third world country images to think that there were kids that weren't getting enough to eat in America. But that wasn't where the problem was. It was still malnourishment, but it looked different. It wasn't starvation. So I spent that first summer on the job kind of going around to our different markets and visiting, you know, what were summer meal sites. So if you want to think anything about food insecurity, think about, you know, the millions of kids that receive a free lunch during the school year. Where do they go when school is out of session? And so I remember sitting in a basement in Little Rock, Arkansas, and at one of these summer meal sites, and the kids all coming in. And the thing about, much like grief, the thing about a child who's hungry is you cannot, there's nothing that necessarily in their makeup of their outward appearance shows.
Would let you know, yeah.
And that makes the work really hard. But that also made me kind of the right person for this job. I remember sitting to like a brother and next to a brother and sister and just talking to them and talking about their summer and, you know, were they having fun? And they were talking about how they had walked, you know, a mile to get to the summer meal site. And then I, at the end of it, I asked them their age. And the whole time I thought I was talking to a young girl who's maybe like 8 or 9 years old. And when she told me she was 13, about to turn 14, that was my moment of it was like, okay, this is what it looks like. She's so malnourished, she hasn't even developed into, you know, an adolescent. And again, she could walk around this entire world and nobody would stop and say, oh, she's hungry. But that's where in lies the problem. And so it was big. I'm glad we're talking about it more now. There's way more awareness about it now.
I'm super passionate about it. I mean, I think for me, I'm big on food and education. And I don't think people realize a lot of times that the malnourishment not only affects the child physically, but mentally. They're not focused in school. It affects them in so many areas of their life. And you're right, because we're expecting to see a billboard of somebody that's looking just completely malnourished, like you see on an infomercial. They don't realize that it looks like any kid walking down the street this day and age. And like you said, this young girl's 13 years old, but resembles the body and the makeup of a 9-year-old. So it's definitely something that I think hopefully the country's going to start focusing on more, making food more accessible, putting better ingredients. And I think it is something you're seeing in trends. I mean, McDonald's, all these different groups, Arby's, obviously, it sounds like kind of led it initially, are all changing up their menu items to be much, much healthier alternatives than just pure crap.
Yeah. And I would just say, I mean, if you care about anything in youth development, hunger should be on your radar, because it is step one. If a child is not getting enough to eat, they cannot learn, they cannot play sports, they cannot read, they cannot develop into anything that will be a value to the workforce. They certainly can't live happy lives. And that's where I think, you know, Arby's has gotten it right, is just like this, before we can take on anything, if our kids are not getting enough to eat, our future is...
Agree. And you see great organizations now, Strength, and a lot of folks doing some wonderful things in the community. So So now, how long are you with Arby's and the foundation before you kind of go on to your current venture?
So I was there like 4.5 years.
Okay.
A good run. And just honestly, it started to get the itch that I wanted to get back out and do something myself. You know, I am a creator. I like to have big blank canvas, but like my paint are people, you know, so I like to describe it. So I was ready to be kind of an architect of something new. I didn't know what that was. I've always had kind of this kind of underlying thesis around my work that is kind of living by giving. And I started to get pulled a little bit more into that, writing, doing some media pieces, you know, kind of like on the Today Show, and some media bits around just how, you know, again, the number one non-pharmaceutical remedy for depression is
love.
Volunteering.
Okay.
So helping others is just, you know, again, it's obviously what moves me through life, but I think it is, it's so paramount in like our own health and well-being, is just helping somebody else. And when we look at philanthropy and we look at where we should get involved in the community, we're wired to think that we should give away that which we have an abundance of. And my thesis is the exact opposite, that you should actually look at that which you've lost. That can come in a lot of different things. Look at that which has created struggle in your life, because it happens to us all, and go in and do that to help somebody else. Go and use that, like lean into that which is your weakness, or is your struggle. And that is where you should apply your giving back and your philanthropy. And it's different than the message that we usually get, but it is important, because I think when you find something that you are connected to directly is when you really start to understand how transformative giving can be. It's really easy to write a check for somebody or something that is like way far away from the best.
Yeah.
It's a lot harder to do something that's like really close to what you do. But I stand kind of with the argument that go there. I did that with Kate's Club, and then I did that with Arby's from the brand. So I thought that's what I was going to go do.
Yeah.
And I sat with one of my great mentors who kind of just say, I'm thinking, you know, is it going to be consultancy? What is the vehicle that I'm going to bring this to life? And do you have any advice? And she happened to be the new president of the Chamber of Commerce, Hala Modelmog. And she was like, you know, gosh, I wish I had something for you. I've just got this marketing campaign. I was like, well, what's that? And she's like, well, we just launched this thing called Choose ATL. And, you know, it's all about marketing Atlanta to get young talent to move here. And she kind of was like, she kind of explained it. Now, you know, I was kind of like, I don't know if that's for me, but shoot me the job description. Maybe I'll know somebody. And I went away from that conversation, I think not thinking, like kind of just being like, oh, this is like, you know, kind of an advertising campaign. This isn't me. This is media buying. And then overnight, just something happened sitting with it where I was like, okay, this is actually really big. This actually could be really, really big and transformative. And it's around community, which I love. And it's around building a brand, which I love. And I will share this kind of in a bit of an embarrassing way, but I also was like, you know, there was a part of me that was trying to test the waters if I was going to be right for, you know, running for office one day or something like that. So I was like, maybe this will just, being in this environment, it'll kind of, you know, dip my toe in it. And so I called Hala back and just said, I actually think you guys are thinking a bit too small about this.
I love it.
And she was like, well, what do you have in mind? And I started to paint the picture for her. And she was like, well, you know, would you like to come run it? And so it just kind of happened from there. And every day since, the vision for it has gotten bigger. It's one of the most thrilling rides I've been on, because I'm dealing with the city that there's so much momentum behind. Yet the world just still has no idea. So yeah. As a marketer, it's just like,
it's the most frustrating, but also the most rewarding, because you get to kind of put people on to a city that they may not otherwise know is amazing.
Yeah.
So when you got into this role, you've been here how long now?
With 2 years.
So 2 years.
2 years.
In 2 years, a lot has happened in the city of Atlanta.
Yeah.
I mean, we've had Mercedes come, Porsche come. There's a lot of other companies looking right now. You know, it's kind of crazy, because when you look at your career trajectory, you've literally done, like you said, living by giving in different capacities.
Right.
So by charitable, by, you know, foundation causes within communities. And now you're literally giving back to the city in a sense, in a lot of ways, both economically, talent wise. So what does a typical day even look like in your world? Because I'm sure there is not one day that looks normal.
Yeah, every day is different, which isn't that what we aspire to? I know I'm living in creative abundance when my calendar change, you know, is different every day, which is really important for me and to stay happy. But yeah, I mean, when you look at Atlanta, and I'll tell you again, where I came on was a point at which Atlanta, a lot of companies were coming. Atlanta was coming back from the recession. Atlanta came back from the last recession, the 2010-11 recession, a little bit later from the rest of the country. But when it came back, it just came back with a storm. So Mercedes was choosing Atlanta, Porsche, you know, NCR, like these companies were coming. The problem was the talent was not. And it goes back to that original theory around if you build it, they will come. Cities and regional, you know, economic development agencies were going through that paradigm shift, and they didn't realize it, that a place like Atlanta, which had drafted off of having brands here for so long, you know, for the boomers, you know, and even the Xers, we're not living in a world where if you build it, they will come. So the talent wasn't coming. And in fact, the talent that we were educating here was leaving. So we had a massive problem. The outlook was not good. We were growing jobs, but we were losing labor force. Total, like, not a good recipe for success. And that's why HALA launched Choose ATL, was we needed to go direct to consumer, which was the talent, and attract them to Atlanta. And I knew from a social impact standpoint, from a brand architecture standpoint, that meant we had to go out and meet them where they're at, bring them everything that gets their attention and gets them excited, and then bring them to Atlanta. The good news was I didn't have to make up anything. I mean, we know, like, Atlanta has the dream pieces that you would want when it comes to creative culture, influential culture, music, food, but also the industry that was growing here with the jobs, the startups, all of that stuff. And that's what we've seen just totally take off. And I'm really proud. It's we still have a lot of work to do, but in 2 years, we've been able to get that labor force collectively, obviously not just alone, but, you know, having an initiative that is, you know, intentional about attracting that generation. You know, we've been able to get that labor force up to where it's sustaining with the growth of the jobs. So we're now growing, you know, four times as many jobs as trending in the U.S., but so is our labor force. So as long as we can keep those kind of ticked and tied, then we're doing okay. But we also just, the fun part of my day is, you know, I go and meet with, you know, heads of talent, culture, you know, chief culture officers, CEOs of all these companies. And then I go and I meet with, you know, our creative influencers. I get the great fortune of, you know, working with Love Renaissance and, you know, Ludacris, you know, and Will Packer. Because a bit of my whole thesis around this is that where Atlanta has always had a strong traditional industry sector and a strong creative industry sector, they've never played in the same sandbox. And that's why we've never been known as a globally vibrant city.
You're like the new head coach of Atlanta in a way, bringing all these things together.
Hence, trying!
Once again, community. But you know what? It's interesting.
It is
community. You really are bringing together the entertainment world, the corporate world, the charitable world, all these different variables, and putting them together on the same team in a lot of ways, which, like you said before, was just running very linear. Not everybody was working together. So what's kind of next for yourself and for Choose that you're kind of excited about or you know, looking to kind of kick off here?
So what I'm most excited about is we've intentionally kind of the past 2 years wanted to build equity and credibility of the brand within Atlanta. So the young people are aware of it. They believe in what we're trying to do. Although I do have to remind everybody that I am the marketer, not the mayor. So I cannot change certain policies. You know, I can do what I can do in the narrative around that, which is, you know, we feel is threatening our city, gentrification, income. You know, I care about all those things for sure. And we want to build the most equitable version of ourselves as we grow. But I'm in charge of marketing. So I'm really about amplifying, letting the world know what Atlanta is. But also to me, the Choose ATL brand and the architect of the brand is for our own community being the aspiration, leading us to the aspiration that we wish to be. So the past 2 years, we've tried to really just build the audience to do that, start to play with out-of-market experiences, how we can bring the world here, whether that's literally bring the world here, like with Breakout, or virtually and, you know, bring the, you know, or kind of go out to bring the world like we do with our Choose ATL houses at South by Southwest and kind of these other tentpole moments. We will in 2018 really, really go big out-of-market. It will really be the year where we pivot from we feel like we have our signature kind of plays and experiences here from kind of our After Five program to our block parties. But next year, we're really going to go out and just kind of what I would say, like, reintroduce Atlanta to the world.
Atlantify the world.
Atlantify the world, yeah. And that's already happening. I think we know that's already happening. The provenance of so much creativity and influence is happening here.
Yeah.
But but the problem is that because we aren't intentional about it, we don't control our own story. And therefore, when a hit is made or the fact that we're number one in film production and nobody knows that, the fact that, you know, we have, you know, the best studio music studio production anywhere in the world, that these hit makers are coming to Atlanta to make their hits. That all happens behind the scenes.
Yeah, I don't think most people
know. So we don't get credit for it.
No, I mean, people know Atlanta now because of Donald Glover, right? But most people don't know Stranger Things. They don't know a lot of this stuff. Some of the best production being done is Atlanta-based right now.
Every Marvel movie's made here. So and that's just because that we that's who we are. We are the creators. We're the provenance.
But we're also very humble and behind
the
scenes.
Yeah. And we've got to do a better job of if we want to be that globally relevant city, we have to amplify our creative culture. To do that, we have to work together to make sure that Tether is still tied back to Atlanta. There's so many who knews about Atlanta, you know, and it's kind of mind blowing. But we want what we're going to start to do and what we're going to launch in 2018 is making sure that when something does break out in the world and it's, you know, on a stage or on a screen, and it's tied to Atlanta, that the world knows that it's tied to Atlanta.
Very cool.
Even if by the time it makes it to that hot moment, Atlanta's nowhere in sight.
I'm all about it. Yeah. I love it. I love ATL.
So that's the promise.
Choose ATL.
Yeah.
So, you know, look, I appreciate you coming in today. I appreciate you sharing your story, both personally, professionally. I think hopefully people will have some amazing takeaways from this. For those that want to get in touch with you or want to learn about the different organizations or businesses that you're associated with, how can they go about doing so?
Yeah, so katesclub.com is where you can find out more about Kate's Club. And if you are somebody, I will say this, if you are somebody who is looking to be inspired around your own grief or you're kind of going through your own shit, this is a great organization to get involved with. It really allows you to have a human experience with impacting a young person's life. I would say if you're want to learn more about Atlanta or you're in Atlanta and you want to look how to get involved with chooseatl.com is that website. Follow us on Instagram, Twitter. We do a lot of giveaways. We like to be kind of the point of access to the 60 festivals that we have in this city, the major sporting events. I mean, golly, the lineup. Just this week we announced MLS All-Star Games coming in 2018.
Shout out Atlanta United.
Yeah, Atlanta United. I could sit here all day and talk about all the great things that are happening. But chooseatl.com, find us, follow us. And then I will just drop another URL to keep your eye on, and that is THEA. So that is THEA.network. We'll probably have to do a whole nother podcast about that, but that's a little teaser for what we have coming up that will help us kind of be the storyteller of Atlanta for the world. So check that out.
Amazing. So pretty much, you know, we started off this conversation. You said you almost did your life backwards by going foundation to, you know, Arby's to Choose. But I almost feel like you did it right. It seems like everything that you started with kind of put you and prepared you for this moment on a scale that you're literally going to change a city. And I think you did it the right way and everything happens for a reason. So one takeaway for anybody that's listening today that, you know, wants to be an entrepreneur or a founder or affect people's lives or be, counterculture in whatever they're trying to shift, what piece of advice would you give them?
Hold the vision, trust the process. Like it can be so unconventional. And there are going to be times that you're going to just want to, every inner cell is going to want to fight that. But the one thing that I always come back to is if you are given the gift of a vision, if I were to sing a tune right now, like, whew, no, that was not my gift. But if you're given the gift of a vision, go for it. And don't let go of how big it has to be. I mean, that's the great thing about, I think the one thing about Kate's Club that I always said in my head was, it will be as big as it needs to be.
Love
and then
it.
Just have peace with that.
Well, listen, I appreciate you coming on today. I know we both share a love for Atlanta. But thank you for the time, and once again, appreciate it. Thanks, Kate.
Thanks, Justin.
Once again, I'm your host, Justin Epstein, and thank you for listening to Culturation. As always, this show has been powered by Premiere.